Today's program is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. Did you know that Wisconsin wins more national and international cheese awards than any other state or country? To learn more, visit wisconsincheese.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
You're listening to Meant to be Eaten on Heritage Radio. I'm your producer and new host, Coral Lee. Today we're continuing the conversation on visual consumption. Joining me today is Brooklyn food artist Jen Monroe of Bad Taste. Jen's work continually pokes at our relationship to food, at times encouraging full indulgence and immersion, and other times complete and utter aversion. She's hosted a series of 10-course monochromatic dinners, dreamt up a dystopian seaweed-heavy menu responding to climate change, and is easily the resident expert on all things cotton candy. This is all to say she's certainly wrestling with what is and what isn't meant to be eaten. Welcome, Jen.
Thanks so much for having me.
So first things first, why Bad Taste?
Yeah, Bad Taste was originally meant to be a publication when I was in school and was sort of just starting to dip my toe into more theoretical thought about the world around me. I really was kind of seeing an absence in the food writing and the food writing world. I didn't really see a lot of food publications that were really kind of tapping at what makes our relationship with food kind of bizarre and interesting and squishy and difficult to pin down. That was right around the time that Lucky Peach came out, and that for me felt like kind of a pioneering publication in the way that the mainstream is approaching food and food media. And since then, luckily, the landscape has changed a lot in terms of how and what we talk about when we talk about food. But at the time, I really wanted to kind of, you know, get some of these nascent ideas that I was having out there, and I really wanted Bad Taste to be the food publication. I very quickly understood that making a publication is very hard and very expensive, and people don't want to write for free, bizarrely. And so the idea kind of got scrapped. The dinners started happening kind of shortly after, and at the time I didn't really think they were going to turn into like a thing, quote unquote. They were just something that my sister and I were doing out of our apartment, like for fun, for friends, and we weren't charging admission or anything like that. But after a while, it did sort of start to snowball into more and more of a thing, then Bad Taste felt like a pretty natural name for it. Because I did want it to have a sense of humor, and I did want it to sort of poke fun at, you know, ideas about taste and class and fancy restaurant culture, and to sort of try to subvert those things and to turn them inside out a little bit.
Right. So what inspired those monochromatic meals?
Yeah. So there's a book called A Rebours, which is French for sort of against nature. And it's written by an author whose name I'm going to totally butcher the pronunciation of, J.K. Huysman, I believe is sort of how it's pronounced. And it's a pretty old book. It's about a kind of aging, very, very wealthy, eccentric aristocrat. It's kind of one of the like decadent aesthetic novels in the same ballpark as Oscar Wilde. And the main character, who's effectively the only character, is sort of aging, and he decides he wants to hole himself up in his fabulous mansion and not really talk to anyone for the rest of his life, and spend all of his money on these ridiculous, lavish aesthetic experiments. And one of them is that he has an all-black funeral banquet for his libido as he sees it disappearing. And that my sister and I both read the book independently of one another, and that sequence always really stuck with us, that the all-black food sounded really, really striking and beautiful. And so we kind of said, oh, like, let's have our own. And then from there, it was like, let's do other colors too. And it sort of spiraled from there.
What were the unique challenges of cooking with just one color? Because, you know, there's the fear of anything being one note.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, in a lot of ways, it makes it easier to cook with only one color because your options are extremely limited. So it's a lot different than trying to plan another menu where you can do anything. So the process is you make a list of all of the foods in the color that you're after, and then you sort of stare at the list for a little while, and then from there dishes sort of start to kind of just combine themselves before your eyes. Sort of the natural food pairings just kind of show up. But yeah, what's challenging about that is limitation. It's the same thing that makes it easy in a way. you know, you'll be tasting something and you'll, you know, if you're, for example, cooking all black food, you're like, I really want some like fat in this thing. I want like some dairy. And you're like, oh, like, how do I do that? And so then you kind of try to approach it backwards. So maybe instead of using dairy, you're going to be using like century egg for some fat. That's going to be like a darker color or something like that. Or like you could try making like a squid ink butter or something like that. But it's never really a straight line from A to B the way it is with normal cooking, where you're like acid, lemon, like fat, salt, whatever. It's, you have to kind of come at things in a funny backwards way. And then ingredient sourcing is often a nightmare. I'm not fully legitimized enough to be working with like, you know, big, large scale ingredient sourcers or anything like that, because I'm never really buying in huge quantities, which is sort of a problem about being a small fish in a big pond, I guess. So yeah, it's a lot of like harrowed last minute scurrying all over Chinatown, like trying to track things down in a panic, which is something that you've actually helped me with before. So, you know what that's all about.
Yeah, and how does eating one color affect taste, or at least your expectation of taste?
Yeah, I've never actually sat through an entire monochromatic dinner, which is very sad for me, so I don't totally know the answer to that question. But my hope is that it acts as a kind of sensory disorientation in a way, that when you're approaching something so visually, you kind of project your expectations about what a color tastes like onto something, and then when you actually experience real taste, which is diverse, it's not, you know, a one-note monochromatic flavor, as it were, it's a little bit startling, it's a little bit alienating, or at least that's my hope, that it sort of reacquaints you with senses in a different way.
And so one of the meals that you served was a white meal, mm-hmm. and one of the white meal courses was served on a white iPhone, which was of course beautiful and really striking, like you just said, also kind of undeniably sinister, metacritical. And so can you talk more about the process of that course?
Sure. Yeah, that was an idea that I had kind of kicking around for a really long time. It kind of came from a couple different directions. The first one was just thinking about in fine dining culture, how there's an impulse to just sort of make food plated as lavishly and often as expensively or impractically as possible, while, you know, still kind of getting away with it as normal or sort of normalized. So like, you know, edible gold leaf is a really obvious example of that. But then there's also, I mean, this is a theme that has launched a million angry tumblers, but like serving food on non-food things. So like, we're serving this off of, like, you know, it starts with a cheese slate and then you end up as like, we're serving food off of basketball shoes and like, I don't even know, like metalwork. And it's just like, it gets really crazy. So I wanted to think about that. And if you think about, you know, what the most expensive thing is in terms of square inches that you could serve food on, it's like electronics. And it's also like, you know, if you are wealthy enough that you can be, I used to work at a salt store, where we had these Himalayan pink salt blocks that people could eat food off of, and it was everything was obscenely expensive. It was in the West Village, and you know, I'm selling people things that I can't really afford, and I definitely drank the Kool-Aid in a lot of ways, thinking about like, well, one day I'll be like a fancy West Village lady, and I'm gonna have like a sushi party where all the food gets served off of pink salt blocks, and like every block costs $200, and then I'll have made it, you know. And that's totally not real. Like, that's not a real dream. That's a terrible dream. But thinking about like taking that to its sort of next level is like, whoa, what if you have a dinner party where everyone's eating food off of iPhones? So the iPhones were fake. They were movie props, but they felt very real. And so, yeah, trying to sort of subvert that. And then, of course, when you send out food that looks crazy, all people want to do is bust out their phones and take pictures of it. So it sort of turns into like a weird plate and mirror situation. That was my hope anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's this picture online of this kind of iPhone within an iPhone within an iPhone, mm-hmm. which I thought was really funny.
My dreams look like that.
So you also did a pink meal. And 2 weeks ago, we spoke with Pietro of the famed Millennial Pink Cafe, yeah. Pietro Nolita. And while it's easy to be jaded or cynical of the influencers sharing these pink photos, there's also some kind of deeper truth that's revealed in connecting fashion and color and food. Mm-hmm. And why do you think we have this need to show those around us that we're tastemakers, or at the very least in tune with what the tastemakers like?
Yeah. I mean, I think that phenomenon in itself is not a new one at all. We just have a new method of making it more constant and more visible, directly signifying, I guess. It's like, when you look at someone's Instagram, you can very quickly sort of parse out what kind of person they want you to think they are. And you can sort of choose or not to believe that, but you usually do believe it. And I think taste making is just a sort of new, more financially driven word for something that's existed a long time. I mean, if we think about food, like gourmet and gourmand culture have been around for a couple centuries, and you know, we look at, you know, I love to think about like flipping through Gourmet magazine in the 90s and what food photography looked like then. And it was definitely selling a different lifestyle, but it was still selling a lifestyle. And we're doing the same thing now. I think the color pink is particularly interesting as we're thinking about Instagram culture and things like millennial pink and, you know, the idea that you can eat. And I think it's fascinating what Pietro Nolito is doing, is that, you know, the idea that you can kind of eat in a restaurant and be in an environment where you're kind of consuming like the design experience that you want to project about yourself, right? Like, don't we all fantasize about living in a all pink house? I mean, I do. And, you know, things, environments that are meticulously decorated, if we're quite literally eating in them and taking pictures of them, then that's kind of what we're broadcasting as our own home on the internet in a way that I think is really interesting.
Mm-hmm. And there's this kind of new democratization of taste, like with Yelp and how anyone can become a food critic. But also it seems like small businesses are easily wrecked by these bad reviews that are written on a whim, like, oh, I got a bad Diet Coke, or my service was bad that one day. Yeah. Right, exactly. And why do you think we have this kind of fear of stumbling into a cafe that's not so highly rated or not so reviewed?
Yeah.
And yeah, we just have to rely so much on others.
Well, it goes both ways. There's the, like, one angry person can ruin a whole cafe. And then on the other hand, if you're, you know, for example, a restaurant that's mostly doing delivery on Seamless as your means of making money, then you're probably going to pay for some bots to churn out a couple hundred or thousand fake reviews. You know, you'll look at this, like, there's a new Indian restaurant that's only been around for 6 months and they have 15,000 reviews. And you're like, you know, those aren't real, but they're all glowing. So, like, I guess I'll eat here. I don't know. It's very bizarre when, you know, the idea of the review, the authenticity and the sort of human belief sort of starts to mean less. I saw a video the other day about a guy who set up a fake restaurant in his, well, he lived in a shed basically in someone's backyard in the UK, and he set up a restaurant that literally did not exist, and started basically bribing his friends to write fake reviews on TripAdvisor, and within a couple weeks became the number one rated restaurant in all of London, but no one had ever eaten there. Like,
that's
it was
crazy.
Just this fake thing. So then he was like, okay, I have to actually have a dinner there. And, but he had no money. So he kind of fed everyone microwaved dinners basically, but did it in a sort of outside, like, edgy, unique feeling environment. And people literally ate it up. They were like, this is so special and what a meaningful experience. And in a lot of ways, it probably was a really special, you know, you're like in some guy's backyard and there's like, he's like, you know, handing you a, like his moldy old blanket because it's cold outside and there's like chickens running by. Like, that seems pretty cool. But yeah, that is a long winded way of saying that, when we rely so heavily on the word starts to mean even less and less. And I think for people who are genuinely concerned about going to a restaurant that isn't highly reviewed on Yelp, that, you know, that reflects on you. You know, if you bring a date somewhere and it's not actually a cool restaurant, then you have bad taste. You have poor judgment. You don't know what's cool. And, you know, where you've wasted your Instagram window for the evening, and or you've reflected poorly on yourself and your own judgments.
I'm going to kind of circle back and go back to this climate change dinner party that you hosted. Can you talk a bit about that and what that even means?
Yeah, totally. Well, you were there, luckily, so you got to,
to
eat it with us. Yeah, Coral was at the dinner. The dinner kind of came to be when there's an author that I met on Instagram named Alexandra Kleeman. She somewhat recently wrote a book called You Too Can Have a Body Like Mine, and a lot of her literary work sort of focuses on the body, and especially on women and what culture kind of does to the way women relate to food and to their bodies and to sexuality, and some of those kind of darker undertones that I think a lot of overlap with what my food work is concerned with. And so I was kind of instantly a big fan of hers. And she was asked to collaborate on an event with a production group called The Bellwether, and what they do is effectively like combine artists to present things in interesting and sort of interdisciplinary ways a lot of the time. And so she said, well, what I want to do is that I've been writing these kind of short sort of mood pieces about, you know, a future kind of dystopic ocean world in which many of the fish and the aquatic species that we take for granted now are gone, you know, that we're looking at an empty ocean and, you know, a world in which babies are born without ever having been able to, like, you know, go out on a kayak and, like, engage with animals in the ocean. So writing about that, and she says, I want to do a dinner that kind of approaches those food ideas more directly and pair it with some of these text pieces that I've been working on. So I was super psyched, obviously. And I had never really done anything quite so politically oriented. I mean, there's definitely a political undertone to some of the color pieces, for example, but this one was a lot more explicitly having a social cause. And it was really cool. The idea effectively was that some of the courses were trying to embrace food ingredients that scientists predict will still be somewhat readily available in 30 years. The idea was that the meal was set 30 years in the future, which is predicted to be kind of a like an environmental turning point in terms of species availability and the way food chains build on one another. So 30 years is kind of like a point of no return, as it were, in terms of ocean food sources. So a lot of the courses were sort of built around things that we predict are still going to be doing okay. So like seaweed, kelp, and different kinds of microalgae, things that can function as invasive species. So like jellyfish is a really big one. They're a majorly invasive species, and they seem to be thriving in the oceans for reasons that we may or may not totally understand. Certain kinds of shellfish seem to be doing okay. But a lot of, you know, larger, more top of the food chain things like tuna and salmon and swordfish, and those are the things that are not doing too hot even now as a product of overfishing and acidification and things like that. So the idea was to avoid those and to sort of focus on sort of more unusual and less embraced food sources. And yeah, so that was the idea, and kind of trying to present those things in a pleasurable way, even though they're maybe some more unfamiliar tastes and ingredients.
What were the courses that you served?
Oh, gosh. pop quiz. Let me try to remember. We opened with a cocktail that was like a mezcal pineapple cocktail, but I made ice cubes that had spirulina, which is a kind of microalgae in them. And the idea is that when you first start drinking the drink, it looks pretty normal, but as the ice cubes melt, they sort of start to tint the drink this kind of like dark, murky kind of aquamarine blue-green color, and by the time you get to the bottom of the drink, that color has sort of intensified, and the flavor was pretty subtle but maybe a little bit more noticeable by the time you're done with the drink. So that was sort of meant to be, you know, a consideration of the gradual and maybe not immediately noticeable implications of climate change, but the ways in which those things sort of build and sneak up on you even if you're not immediately aware of them. And then we did an appetizer course that was a prawn cracker with avocado, finger lime, which are these sort of, they kind of look like caviar. They're this citrus from, I think, Australia. And I sort of meant to think about that as like, well, if caviar isn't available, how will we approach sushi courses? And this might be like an alternative flavor. It's obviously a completely different taste, but they sort of look and texturally feel sort of similar. So finger lime, avocado, a little bit of shiso leaf. I did salt cured egg yolk grated on top, and octopus was kind of the centerpiece of that, because octopuses are also doing really well. They have very short life cycles. They kind of like breed hard and die young, and they seem to be doing well in the ocean. We don't know why. Maybe they like warmer waters. Maybe I don't know. It's hard to tell, but that could definitely be like a future of sashimi, would be octopus as an alternative to things like tuna or salmon. The next course was a salad course. So it was, cabbage and a couple different kinds of seaweed. I think there was, I can't even remember now. There was a bunch of different kinds of seaweed, but that was sort of meant to say like, look at alternatives for greens that are really healthy and seem to be really readily available. And they are an excellent carbon sink. So they do a lot of really great things for the ocean. And then that was topped with like a tahini kind of dressing, sort of like a sort of creamy citrusy type of situation. Then the main course, which is kind of the mouthful to explain, was a mussel course. So mussels in a kind of briny dashi miso broth, and the idea was that the bowl acted as kind of like a mini sustainable mussel farm. So the idea for a lot of futuristic ideas about how we're going to do aquaculture has to do with raising a couple species in the same pool that are kind of mutually sustainable. So if you have mussels and shrimp coexisting in the same pool, then the idea is that the shrimp can filter out the mussel excrement, effectively, to put it politely. And then if you get seaweed going on in the same pool, then that's going to act as kind of a carbon sink and a means of reoxygenating the water. So that's a really great way to sort of have three really valuable food crops in one. So there was a little shrimp bubble of fermented shrimp paste that you could kind of drop into the into the broth and swish a little around to melt it. And then there was a couple different kinds of seaweed floating around in the broth as well. And then I served that with ocean bread, which is bread made with ocean water in the dough as a means of kind of making it more salty and briny and interesting flavored. And then that was topped with uni butter, so to add a little bit of kind of salt and fat and a little bit of funk. And then there was a fruit course, which was a bunch of different kinds of fruit that I think we tend to think of as sort of seasonally ubiquitous and available all the time in grocery stores. So things like pineapple and grapes and mangoes, things that, you know, definitely have a lot of miles on their backs when we import them from all over the world, just as a way to sort of think about, like, you know, where and when does your food come from, and why are there always grapes in the grocery store, and why do we take those things for granted? Whereas I think a lot of people who cook more seriously would, you know, never dream of sort of trying to make like a tomato salad in the middle of winter, but are still gonna, I don't know, be sourcing lots of grapes and even I eat pineapple all year long, which is probably not the most sustainable food choice, but so that course was these sort of big slabs of fruit that diners were able to dip into little bowls of seawater. And then the fruit was topped with like a little bit of a spicy chili situation. And then the dessert course, was, we called it the Five Futures because as Alex, the author, and I were talking, I think we were sort of spinning our own wheels going like, there's so many different ways that this could go, and there's so many different angles, and how do we even talk about the future when we don't totally know? And so, you know, we were sort of writing out all these different things, like, is it going to be sci-fi? Is it going to be the future? Is it going to be the Hunger Games? Is it going to be, you know, a really hardcore farm-to-table? And so we decided, like, okay, what if we could present all five of those options at the same time? And so we sort of presented a dessert plate with five different little bites on it, and each one was meant to sort of represent a different way in which the future could go.
Mm-hmm. And so one of those options for the dessert was this little Jello cube, which was half blue, half pink, and it was kind of like the women, right, would eat the pink side and the men would eat the blue side.
Yeah.
And so this kind of predicts this future in which we're eating solely for fuel or maybe supplements, mm-hmm. or, you know, nutrition instead of just pleasure. And do you think this is a viable future?
I don't think in our lifetimes or really any time after that. I mean, I have no idea when or if, you know, if nuclear war happens and we actually do destroy all hopes of an agricultural future, then yeah, maybe we will have to be kind of synthesizing all of our food in labs and getting nutrition from maybe less orthodox ways. But I think as a species, we've always been really good about finding and inventing pleasure for ourselves. And I think we'll continue to do so, particularly with what the food conversation looks like now. I think we're much too curious and too pleasure driven to kind of, you know, turn into a Soylent Green situation anytime soon.
You've been listening to Meant to be Eaten on Heritage Radio. Brooklyn-based food artist Jen Monroe and I are talking about the other ways we consume food today, and we'll be right back after the break.
Today's program was brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. What do you think of when you hear Wisconsin cheese? For me, I think cheese curds. Delicious, fresh, and squeaky cheese curds. Or deep-fried cheese curds. Cheese curds literally any way, anytime, any place. I think about Andy Hatch and Uplands Cheese, the farmstead cheese company behind Pleasant Ridge Reserve. I think of delicious stinky Limburger and its long storied history. I think of Dunbarton Blue, made by master cheesemaker Chris Raleigh. I think of Ross Grand Cru Sirchois, which was named 2016's World Championship Cheese, and Sutari's Black Pepper Bellavitano, the 2017 U.S. Championship Cheese. Wisconsin produces the world's best cheese, with lush grasslands and a glacial water supply that produce the very best milk, fourth-generation cheesemakers combine old-world tradition with new ideas and the highest standards to make innovative cheeses that win more awards than any other state or country.
And we're back with Jen Monroe of Bad Taste.
Hi.
While the qualifier Instagrammability in determining whether or not we should eat at, let alone visit, a restaurant is a new one, the aesthetic experience of food is certainly not. In what ways, other than with our mouths, do you think we consume our food?
Well, with our eyes is the good answer to that question. And that's also not a new phenomenon. I mean, people have been thinking about what food looks like for a really long time. I was finally gifted the Salvador Dali cookbook for Christmas this year after asking for it 2 years in a row. And thinking about the aesthetics of food is not new, but now it's, you know, so much more easily distributable, the image. And so we obviously take advantage of that.
You showed me this essay by Roland Barthes, and he kind of predicted that we would perceive and engage with food in a kind of classist way. And do you think this is true, and do we see this today?
I do. And I think when he talks about classism, he's maybe not talking about it in as strictly ominous as a way as we do when we talk about classism. I think there's definitely a lightheartedness to it. But he talks about, like, one of the examples that he cites in the essay that I love is he talks about coffee and what it means when someone takes a coffee break. And I guess in France, that coffee is marketed very heavily as a kind of a relaxing product, which mm-hmm. I don't really relate to. But that commercials about coffee are always all about selling ideas of, like, you're so stressed out, you gotta relax, you gotta take a coffee break. And so that's kind of like sort of a quick signify. I mean, I see people like, oh, I'm really busy and stressed out, I got to take a cigarette break. And I think in a lot of ways, that's kind of like a performative thing that maybe isn't actually doing much of a function other than like making you visibly busy or important or like needing a timeout. And I think what he's talking about with coffee kind of means the same way. And I think that is it's a class distinction in that that's a way of people sort of readily identifying themselves as a certain kind of person. But I don't think it necessarily has to apply to as strict of a sort of like a classist system as what we think about. And he applies the same model to things like the business lunch, right? Or even to like Clif bars or snack bars that, like, if you're someone who, like, you're like at work and you're like working so hard, you like got to eat a Clif bar, that like that is kind of meant to be a sort of showy way about like what kind of busy and important and energy intensive person you are. And I think that in itself is a kind of classism without necessarily saying, like, I'm very rich or I'm very powerful or I have excellent taste. It's just saying, like, I'm important and I need my energy needs. And, you know, similarly, you have, like, computer programming type people who are, really hell-bent on staying in front of their computer and working really hard for 12 hours, and they're going to be looking to something like Soylent to sort of signify that. And it does meet a caloric need, you know. If you're really busy, you truly don't have time to get up, it's going to be a godsend, but it also identifies you as a certain kind of person. Yeah. And I think that has, you know, to get back to your earlier question about Instagrammability, I think the same thing is very much happening with the Instagram food culture. You know, it started with like tacos and like lattes with like heart-shaped foam, and now the trend that I'm seeing happening a lot is, I don't know if you have any like more new agey friends, but like adaptogens and like reishi and ashwagandha and stuff like that. And it's funny because I have a lot of kind of more new agey inclined friends, and so I've been watching them do this for years and you know, have it not really be something that's recognized by any kind of mainstream branch of food culture at all. But I noticed a few days ago that the New York Times had published a recipe for, did you see that? Yeah, it was just like the latte with like $200 worth of adaptogens in the ingredients list. And and it's funny because while reading that, you know, as someone who's seen that culture pan out for years, I felt a tug of interest all of a sudden. I was like, oh, maybe I like should do this. But I already know that I don't want to drink that. Like, I've already drank that latte a million times and been like, this doesn't really taste very good and this isn't really what I want. But like, obviously it works for some people, you know, and power to them. But yeah, just feeling the marketing of something that I had been aware of for a long time and feeling it marketed in a new way that suddenly made it look very chic and appealing to me, and feeling that tug. So I see stuff like that happening on Instagram all the time, like matcha lattes is a new one. And thinking about kind of new class identifiers that people use food as on social media.
Yeah, no, there's this, I don't know, he even equates food with triviality in the essay, and we get this similar feeling when we're mindlessly scrolling through our feeds, totally. Right? Like latte art just makes you feel good.
Yeah.
Pretty green matcha lattes make you feel happy.
Like a nice manicure.
Exactly. Yeah. And why do you think this is why food is able to be such a transportive medium then?
God. I guess that's kind of a dark question, right? Like if the pleasure in food lies in its sort of disposability, then like, hoo boy, but at the same time, yeah, that is what's beautiful about cooking for someone is, you know, you make something really beautiful and sometimes really sculptural and maybe something that took days and was a real labor of love to make. And then it's gone and you have to purely live in it and embrace it in a really fleeting sensory way. That might be a little bit of a high and mighty description of like what flicking through an Instagram feed is like, but at the same time, yeah, I think triviality, disposability, and ephemerality are all really meaningful things in the way we experience things.
So with the $200 latte,
right?
And
I didn't actually do the math. I don't know, but it was definitely an expensive morning drink.
Mm-hmm. And with, I don't know if you see the ads for like the Daily Harvest smoothies, mm-hmm. there's like acai bowls. And so how has food come to act as these lifestyle signifiers?
I mean, I think in the same way that anything else, I think in the same way that fancy clothing or like you know, for people who are more interior designy, having like, you know, your $4,000 modernist couch, I think it's the same thing. I think it's commodity. I think it's a kind of commodity fetishism. And I think because in theory, food is maybe a little bit less expensive than a $4,000 couch or like a $500 Missoni sweater or whatever, I think it's maybe a little bit easier for people to identify themselves with it. And I think the hope is that, you know, kind of what you were talking about is the democratization of taste. I think the hope is that a lot of those kind of classist implications sort of start to undo themselves, because it is possible to be, you know, a dumpster diving freegan who is really into like fermenting their own kombucha and like making a million different kinds of pickles and like having homebrew going in their basement, and to be a really committed foodie without necessarily spending $400 on your morning latte, you know. And and I think that is a really cool and hopeful thing. I think there's a lot of work left to be done in the way that this trend continues to unfold. But I think it is exciting that, I mean, I consider myself someone who thinks seriously about food a lot of the time, and I almost never go out to fancy restaurants because I don't have the money, and that's just the reality of it. But I don't think that has prevented me from cooking and exploring in serious ways that mean something to me and say something to me about my interests. So I think it, in a lot of ways, it is kind of exciting to be alive, because gourmet culture isn't, you know, doesn't exist along those really rigid class lines that it might have 30 or 40 years ago.
And what are you working on now?
What I'm working on this week is a food installation for a Fashion Week show. I don't know if I'm allowed to say the designer's name, because I think she might want it to be a surprise, but it's going to be, it's a monochromatic, I guess I shouldn't even say what color it is, but it's a monochromatic food installation, and it's going to be at a restaurant for a Fashion Week presentation this Thursday. So that's kind of what I've got on the brain, and that's kind of interesting for me, because it's not necessarily made with taste in mind so much as visuals, and so it's not meant to be eaten, as it were. And so that's kind of an interesting thing for me to come at it backwards, whereas normally I come at it with taste trying to be the first and most important thing. Mm-hmm. And then the kind of long-term project that I've got my sights set on for now is that I want to do a very large sit-down kind of immersive dinner about bees and colony collapse disorder. And I'm speaking this out loud right now in the hopes that by shouting my dreams out to the world, that it'll make them more able to come true, because it feels like a pretty expensive endeavor that I haven't quite figured out how to fund yet.
You have Venmo.
Yeah, everyone, y'all, Venmo me. Yeah, I know, but it's definitely like I need to just grow up and be a big girl and apply for some grants in a way that I feel daunted by. But so yeah, I do want to do some kind of large scale, more sculptural piece about bees, and my hope is that I can get some real science people involved in a meaningful way and make it kind of a special thing.
I've been talking with Brooklyn-based food artist Jen Monroe on how eating looks today. I'm Coral Lee, and thanks for listening to Meant to Be Eaten on Heritage Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.